We're going to talk about context. So let's do an exercise. What's that word mean? Throw a ball. Okay. Yes, the field on which you play soccer. Okay, what else? Yeah, the angle of one's roof. Or did you mean the substance one uses to seal the roof? Yeah. What else? Ah, sales. Yeah, the point when you're trying to sell something. You're making a pitch. All right, what else? Finally, a musician. Yeah. The frequency and tone, it can be a pitch in music. How do you know which one I mean when I write that word down? Yeah. Context. Here's the principle. If you want to understand a text, you have to understand its context. Very simple. If you want to actually correctly understand, rightly understand a text, you have to understand its context. You don't know what word I mean here without some context. If we are standing on a baseball diamond and I say pitch, you've got a pretty good indicator that I'm talking about throwing a baseball, right? If we're standing on a soccer field, you might have a different understanding. If I'm sitting at that piano, you might have a very different, like, and that's just based on where I am. That's not even taking into account the sentence in which I say the word, right? So if you want to understand a text, if you want to understand a passage of scripture, you actually have to understand it in its context. Here's the picture. See, we've gotten more complicated. We've moved from a line to a series of circles. These circles don't correspond to anything in particular. What it's trying to do is using concentric circles to say there's a relationship between my text, right there at the center, and concepts around it that will help me to understand what exactly my text means. There are four kinds of context that are particularly helpful when doing biblical exegesis. Now, I want to be very careful here. I'm going to have to explain this a little bit more later. But remember, we're on the rectangle here. We're on the part of the rectangle that is exegesis, meaning we're talking about the part that has to do with the first audience. So how did the author write to his initial first audience? How does that context, how did those kinds of context help us to understand what he's saying to that first audience? Four kinds that you really want to think through. Matt's going to be sad they don't alliterate. I know. Yeah. See, you're hearing this as a challenge, aren't you? Yeah. No, we're going to stick with precision of language on this one. If we were talking about music, I would. Literary context. Let me give you a quick definition. Literary context refers to the text on either side. Real simple. What that means is a passage, a sentence, a word has text on either side of it that helps you know what's going on there. So each passage is found in a larger passage, There's a larger set of ideas, a larger argument being argued, a larger concept in which your passage is found, which is going to be shaped by that bigger discussion. So you need to know what's going on in the literature, both before and after your passage, to know how your passage functions in that bigger section. That's going to help you understand your passage and what it's saying in a more particular way. Questions on that? Don't worry, we're going to practice all these. Great. Historical context refers to the point in history of the text, meaning the situation or the circumstances in which the text was both written and received. The circumstances or situation in which the text was both written and received. So, if you know that I'm an amateur musician, and I've been playing with my band, and I'm talking about pitch, you know my circumstances, you know my situation, you know the history that I have in playing music, and you can surmise which version of pitch I'm talking about. Does that make sense? So actually knowing something about the author, why he's writing to whom he's writing, the situation and the circumstances and the place that he's writing to, is going to help you understand what he's saying. Now, let me be very careful on this. In the epistles, which is what we're in this week, we can, generally speaking, reconstruct quite a lot of the circumstances and situation of the original audience, that first audience. In other parts of the Bible, that's a much more difficult thing to do. So you've got to be careful how tied into this idea you are. And I say that because anybody who's been to Bible college or seminary will tend to have a habit of reading the entire Bible like it's an epistle. And that's very problematic. So come back next year or the year after when we do Gospels, and you're going to hear somebody talk about, well, we actually can't really say that much about the audience of Matthew. Like the text doesn't help us understand their circumstances or situation very much. We can guess, and some guys did guess about 150 years ago in German, and then it got translated into English, and everybody thinks it's the truth, but it's actually just a dubious reconstruction. So be very careful reading other parts of the Bible as though they are epistles. In the epistles, we can reconstruct quite a lot. How do we do that? Where do we look in an epistle to reconstruct the historical circumstances or situation? Where might we tend to look for that information? Sorry? Readings? Greetings. Yeah. So at the beginning of the letter, we might get some insight into the church that's being written to or the person that's being written to. Where else? Acts. Yeah. We have a narrative history of a lot of what's going on, and so we can get some insight into the places Paul's writing to and his relationships with those places. Where else? Early, middle, late? It would if you could demonstrate that definitively from the text.
2 Timothy, late, like last, right?
Sure. Yeah, so early, middle, late, I would be pretty comfortable with. Trying to assign a particular year or a particular order gets really difficult. Because again, we're having a high view of Scripture, having a high view of the inerrancy of Scripture, I'm very careful to not say more than I can actually demonstrate from the text. I don't take commentaries as the gospel truth, because it turns out sometimes they're wrong or plagiarized or just dumb. Where else might we look? Just at the beginning of the letter? Yeah, so throughout the letter, right? So the content throughout the letter is going to help us. But in particular, I think the beginnings and the endings of letters give us insight into the church, right? So when Paul gets into you know, talking about who's there and what he's saying to them, or when he's trying to articulate what problem he thinks they're facing, and so he's going to write about that for the next six chapters. Like, those little insights are incredibly important to understanding the historical context of a text. The other one is related letters. So occasionally, we have sets of letters to the same place that we can look at. So very helpful in understanding the context of 2 Timothy, 1 Timothy. Not just Acts, but 1 Timothy. 2 Corinthians, very helpful, 1 Corinthians. Right? Make sense? Those are the places we look for historical context. Cultural context. This, in the epistles, could be very similar to the historical context. I'm making the distinction here because this distinction is really important in other genres. But in the epistles, because there's no distinction between the people in the text being written to and the audience of the document, they're the same, right? So Paul wrote to the church in Ephesus. The people in the book are also the recipients of the book. That's not true in other places in the Bible, right? So the people in the Gospel of Matthew are not necessarily, most likely not, the recipients of the document of the Gospel of Matthew. So there's a distinction between audience in the text and audience of the text. Cultural context, if historical is the situation and circumstances of the people who are receiving the text, cultural is the setting in life of the people in the text that actually needs to be explained sometimes to the recipients of the text. Does that make sense? I know I'm speaking a little bit abstractly here. Like in the Gospels, for example, sometimes there's an explanation of something going on culturally, right? So think John 4, the Samaritan woman, and the author makes some comments that helps the recipients of the text understand the relationships between Jews and Samaritans, right? So there's something in the text that the people in the text understand and don't talk about, but that the author feels the audience of the text needs to understand. So it's those kinds of cultural things, understanding the culture of the people in the text. And again, in the epistles, you don't really need to make the distinction because the recipients of the text are the people in the text. Is that clear? Oh, good. I don't want to belabor it, but I also want to not cause confusion. Biblical. Biblical context is when, and remember, this is why it's so important we remember we're on the exegesis line, because it's the first audience that drives this. So it's when the author uses biblical text, citation, quotation, allusion, that both he and the original audience, the first audience, have in common, and he can rightly expect that first audience to understand it. Does that make sense? So it's a text that they both have access to that he's expecting them to understand. This is different. Biblical context is different than biblical theology, which is up here on the theological reflection line. So up here, chronology doesn't matter. First audience doesn't matter. It's anything that's legitimately connected to my text. That's biblical theology. But down here in biblical context, we're talking about something that both the author and the audience have in common. A text that is being referenced, cited, quoted, alluded to, definitively. Does that make sense? Okay. Bearing in mind these four kinds of contexts, let's work some exercises. We're going to start with my favorite one. Philippians chapter 4, verse 13. I know there's at least one of you here who doesn't even need to look it up. You can say it out loud. What does Philippians 4, verse 13 say? Come on. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Who thinks that's Philippians 4:13? It does say him. You've supplied the Christ there, which is slightly heretical, but still good. I can do all things through him, that is Christ, who strengthens me. Where do we typically encounter this verse? Sports. Yes, sports. One or more professional athletes has referenced this, tattooed this on themselves, inscribed this on their sneakers, and so on, right? Why? No context. Yeah, clearly no context. But why? What are they getting out of this verse? Yeah, confidence, encouragement, motivation, right? I can do what I've set my mind to because Christ strengthens me to do it, right? That's how they're reading that verse, right? And it, not just them. Like, dude, we do this, don't we? I'm not going to make you raise your hand if you've ever used this verse to encourage somebody. But I've found myself tempted to do this. This person's really nervous about going and asking for a promotion at work. What a beautiful verse to give them, right? You can do this. You can go ask for that promotion, right? Right? Works perfectly. It's bad pastoring, though. Why? Because it's out of context. So let's take a look at the context. Let's work on the literary context. Philippians 4:13. Why don't you go ahead and read three or four verses in both directions, get a sense of the larger discussion, and come back to me with some insights onto how this verse is functioning in the larger section. Okay? Take 3-4 minutes, work with the guy next to you. What's going on in the larger passage, and how is this verse functioning in that? Go. All right. What's the larger discussion that's going on here? He's asking for money. As any good pastor does, he's asking for money. Great. No, I meant in chapter 4. What, 2-3 verses, 3-4 verses, either direction. What's the next kind of circle out of literary context here? What's he talking about? Contentment. Contentment in what? Circumstances, both positive and negative, right? He's actually talking through both the highs and lows. And so this shifts our understanding of the verse a little bit, doesn't it? He's talking about, I can be content in Christ no matter my circumstances, which is very different, or at least slightly different than I can do whatever I set my mind to because Christ strengthens me, right? So how does Christ's strength function in those two different worlds? Any thoughts on that? Let's call the one Paul's world of highs and lows and the other one the Tim Tebow world. Yeah. Yeah. God is sustaining him through both good and bad circumstances, right? So the agenda on what Christ's strength is doing is set by God. It is encouraging, sustaining, holding Paul up no matter what the circumstances. Whereas for Tim Tebow, it's who sets the agenda? Tim Tebow does, right? It's whatever I want that God's strengthening me for. That's a very different understanding. All right. Now, let me ask a different question. What circumstances does Paul have in mind? Because he very, in an almost egalitarian way, is quite happy to talk about both the positive and the negative circumstances here, right? He holds them both out equally. How do we know which set of circumstances he has in mind? historical context. So I'm going to rely on your knowledge of Philippians because we're not going to take the time to read the whole book. What's going on in Philippi? What historical context, what situation or circumstances is the reality in Philippi that we can surmise from this book? Paul is in jail. Sorry? Yeah. It's not the good kind of jail. I mean, I don't know if there is a good kind of jail, but it's certainly dire for him. I guess there's good jail in like Sweden or something. I don't know. Sorry, what else? They are advancing the gospel, but what kind of circumstances are they? What's life in Philippi in this church like right now as he writes this letter? Yeah, they're concerned about him. Like this whole him being in jail thing is problematic for them. So who did he send in his place? Epaphroditus. What happened to Epaphroditus? Yeah, he's on his deathbed. This is not good. There are apostles in jail. His replacement's on his deathbed. How are their relations to the other believers in their area or believers in their area? Chapter 3. Anybody read Philippians? Huh? Yeah. Not friendly. They're getting attacked by false Judaizing believers, right? So that's why believers is in quote marks there, because I'm being sarcastic. The things are not good. Like, they're getting attacked. Some of Paul's strongest language in the Bible is reserved for what he thinks of those guys. Yeah, it's, let's call it very nearly vulgar, what he's saying about them. All right, and inside the church, things are just going smoothly, as they do in all Nine Marks churches. at the beginning of this chapter, right? Chapter 4, Yodi and Syntyche stirring up trouble. So, what circumstances does Paul have in mind? Having done some historical context work, read through the book, tried to think about what's the situation in Philippi, what circumstances does Paul have in mind when he's talking about I can be sustained through all circumstances here in chapter 4? Yeah, the bad ones. The bad ones. He's talking about survival, right? I mean, what's the big refrain in Philippians? Rejoice, right? Rejoice. Again, I say rejoice. Rejoice, rejoice, rejoice. Why do you think he's telling them to rejoice so much? Seems like they have a lot of reasons to not be very joyful. So, historical context then helps us to understand. Philippians 4:13 is about surviving the bad stuff that happens because Christ strengthens you. So it's not about winning the game. It's about Christ sustaining you when you've lost the game. It's not about going and getting that promotion. It's about going on when you're denied that promotion. Does that make sense? And all we needed to do to get there was a little bit of literary context, a little bit of historical context. Good? Clear? Money or marriage? What do you guys want to do? Money. All right.
That's easier than marriage.
Exactly one of you voted. This is starting to feel like a Cuban election or something. I don't know. That's fine. If there's only one vote, that vote wins. Let's talk about money. 2 Corinthians 9:6-9. Somebody stand up and read that out loud for us. Amen. How do we want to use this passage? Let's have some fun with this. Take 2 minutes, work with the guy next to you. Yes, I want to hear your three-point outline, because you're Baptist, three-point outline. Completely ignoring the context, all right? So, funniest three-point outline wins $5 American. It'll be up to you how you split it. I don't know how that's going to work, but good luck. Funniest three-point outline. Again, sometimes this is always a dangerous exercise because somebody like super pious comes out with like a really faithful outline here. That's not what we're going for. All right? Pretend you don't know how to read the Bible. In short, pretend you're Anglican for like 3 minutes. Okay? Funniest three-point outline, 2 minutes, go. I'm going to add an extra challenge just to make it a little more difficult. Matt, you can't alliterate. It's really just an extra challenge for him, but there you go. All right, 1 more minute. In case you... Hello. Oh, there it is. In case you didn't make the connection, there's a cash prize because this is a prosperity passage. All right. Who's got an outline they want to share? All right. Loud. You need a microphone so this can be recorded. I'm kidding. Great. Josiah, what did you and Bobby come up with?
Verse 6, the cheap don't reap.
Ooh.
Verse 8, good deeds, no needs.
I was gonna say, I'm getting the feeling this is actually something you've preached. this is feeling a little too mature. Good. What else? All right.
I had to alliterate, though.
Nope, disqualified. That is snappy. You rhymed it, too. All right. Any other late entries? Okay. Let's do show of hands. Option one. You got 4 votes. All right. Option two. Ooh. Option three. That's right. We expect to see that in the offering on Sunday. How do we mobilize this passage often? When do you preach this one?
Beginning of the year.
Huh? Yeah, beginning of the year. Stewardship campaign, January 1. End of the fiscal year, right? Gotta make budget. Right? Once a quarter. Yeah, when the weekly plate has gone down in value, Time to bring out this passage, right? That's how we tend to use it. And believe me, this is my tradition right here, right? So 1662 Book of Common Prayer, which is like the main liturgical resource for the entire worldwide Anglican communion, all 85 million of us, which is a light revision of Cranmer's 1552 Book of Common Prayer, has in it, which by the way is largely a very theologically rich and wonderfully capital R reformed work of theology, solid throughout. Except for this one part, which drives me nuts every week. And that is what are called the offertory sentences. So right after the sermon is preached, right before the table is set up for communion, and during which the offering is collected, there are like 7 or 8 options from the Bible and another 3 or 4 from the Apocrypha of sentences you say out loud as the one presiding over the service to introduce the communion, or to introduce the offering, excuse me. And in fact, it's the only thing you say. And each one of them is a few verses ripped wildly out of context, including these verses right here. So I have the option of saying this every week in the context of we're about to collect the offering for the church. You've probably already figured out there's some other stuff going on here, right? This is a talk on context. So let's very quickly, because we've got about 15 more minutes, let's work some of our context tools here. So let's start with literary context. Talk to the guy next to you. Poke around the beginning of chapter 9, even skim through chapter 8. What's the discussion, and the rest of chapter 9, what's the discussion in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9? What's going on here that might shed some light as to why Paul's suddenly talking about cheerful giving, okay? Take 3 minutes. Again, you're going to have to skim fast. Skim through 8 and 9. Literary context, what's going on here? All right, 2 minutes, go. What's going on here in chapters 8 and 9? So the literary context shows us this isn't just individuals, or maybe not individuals at all, giving to their local church, but it has something to do with churches giving to each other. That's interesting. How does it start up there in chapter 8? Sorry? Yeah, he's talking about the Macedonians and how their incredible circumstances of poverty have produced incredible abundance of generosity, right? Interesting. And he's using that to prod the Corinthians along a little bit. Okay, what else? What else do we learn in these two chapters that might help us begin to understand these four verses? Yeah, it has to do with a particular need in the Jerusalem church, right? That these gifts are being collected to take there. All right, what else?
8:14, the repetition of abundance.
Yeah, so there's a lot on abundance. Abundance of what? Uh-huh.
And so that in the future, vice versa,
they
can help each other out.
Okay. So there's an abundance of resources being talked about, but it leads into something there. Yeah. So look at verse 10, chapter 9, verse 10. He who supplies the need to sow and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. Oh, that's interesting. What does it lead to? An abundance of thanksgiving. So this is actually more than just about resources. Their resources and their giving of resources is tied to their faith, their righteousness, their thanksgiving. So the giving here is representative of something deeper about them as Christians. Okay. It's a good start. If we were preparing this passage to preach, right? So this is the passage the elders have assigned me to preach on Sunday because they notice giving's down. I'm going to do some work. I'm going to start on Monday with some structure work in my study. Wake up. That's what I'm working on. Monday afternoon, I'm going to move to context. I've done some literary context reading now. I've noticed there's something bigger going on here. I need to look into some historical context. So where am I going to look? Beginning and end of the letter, previous letter, Acts, right? That's where I'm going to learn about the circumstances. Now, I'm going to save you some time, and I'm going to tell you where to look for historical context. Because we've learned about this need in Jerusalem and the churches working together. So take a look at Acts 11, 27 to 30, and 1 Corinthians 16, 1 through 4. Work with the guy next to you. What do these two passages teach us about the historical context of our verses in 2 Corinthians? So Acts 11, 27 to 30, 1 Corinthians 16, 1 to 4, historical context. What do we learn about the circumstances of the world that help us understand our verses? All right, go, 2 minutes. All right, what do we learn? Historical context. Huh? Famine in Judea. Yeah, that's what we learn in Acts 11, right? There's a famine predicted, and so they send Saul, a.k.a. Paul, and Barnabas out to go and collect provisions for the church in Judea who's about to get nailed with a famine, right? Interesting. Very, very interesting. What do we learn in 1 Corinthians 16? Yeah, that this is a special offering that they are being instructed on how to collect. Why is that so important? What's Paul doing in writing to them in 1 Corinthians? Hey, here's how I want you to set stuff aside every week so that you're ready. Yeah, so it's separate from funding the local church, okay. What else? What's he actually doing with it in 1 Corinthians 16? Yeah, collecting for what purpose, though? It's a test, isn't it? That's what we learn between 1 Corinthians 16 and 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. It's actually a test for them and their loyalty to him and his gospel, whether they follow through with this. It's a test of their maturity, right? That's what 1 Corinthians is actually all about, is their maturity. Are they grown up enough to weekly sacrifice and collect for the good of a church? Pretty long way away. Which gets back to this, it's more than just about resources, it's about the abundance of righteousness and thanksgiving that this act of sacrificial worship produces in them. Which means our sermon on meeting the church budget because giving is down is actually being drawn from a passage which seems to be about something else. It's about showing our maturity as faithful Christians by giving to those in need halfway around the world. This is the closest you're going to get to, I think, a really solid biblical foundation for worldwide famine relief. So if I'm going to be faithful to this passage, my sermon isn't about we need to meet the budget. My sermon's going to be about we need to increase the missions budget. Maybe. What else is it going to be about? Well, let's do a little biblical context. Anybody notice a citation, quotation, or allusion to another part of the Bible? In our passage, yeah, 2 Corinthians 9, 6 to 9. Yep, verse 9. As it is written, that's a pretty good indicator that we're going somewhere else in the Bible. He has distributed freely. He has given to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. Who is that verse talking about? In the text, in 2 Corinthians. We read that as being about God, right? And God is able to make all grace abound to you so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work. As it is written, he has distributed freely. He has given to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. The third point of everybody's outline. God's going to give to you. Like, you show yourself to be generous, and God's going to give back to you, right? Because that's what he does.
go read the psalm. Take 2 minutes. Work with the guy next to you. What psalm is this? 112. What verse? Okay. Go read the psalm. Read the verse in context. Who is this verse talking about? All right. 2 minutes. Go. All right. Who's the psalm referring to? The righteous man, the one who trusts in the Lord. First time I saw that, that was a little mind-blowing to me, because I'd always read that as referring to God, right? You give to the church, God gives freely to you, because he's righteous. No, no. This is the psalm is actually referring to the righteous man, in contrast to the foolish, wicked man. And the difference between them is the one who's generous. So again, this just doubles down on our point that this is a passage that is not just about giving to those in need, but it's actually giving in those in need in order to demonstrate that we are mature, faithful Christians, that is actually a matter of our maturity. It's a matter of our righteousness as Christians that we are taking care of those in need across the world. Probably not going to help with the church budget this week. But using the context tool in my preparation, I think I've gotten to a more faithful exposition of this passage. And I'm going to trust God to do with that what he's supposed to do with that. Context. Principle. If you want to understand your text, you got to understand the context. Literary, historical, cultural, biblical. If you want to get your text right, you got to understand the context.